to the new episode of Horse Friends. I'm your host, Selina Skogan, and today we take a little deep dive into history, but not as something very distant and dusty. We are looking at horses as connectors across time, culture, and identity. I have two guests from the south of Norway today. We have Caroline Kjesrud from the Museum of Cultural History at the University of Oslo, and we have Søster Jørgensen, who is also a part of the research group, because they have been creating a new initiative, and that is called The Horse. That will become very interesting, and we'll talk a little bit about ecological findings from the Viking Age and a feminist perspective in equestrian history, and of course also the academic art of riding and how this is helping to bring everything together into a modern context. Welcome, Caroline and Sosa.
Thank you.
It's great that you have the time to be here. I'm very excited about the podcast and learn a little bit more about what you are working there. Mm-hmm. So let's have a start with, can you tell me a bit about your research group? It's a new project, right? It's called The Horse.
Yes. It's actually, it's an initiative that was organized to explore the horse from different angles, because at the Museum of Cultural History, for example, and in other museums, we have huge collections, including horse-relevant objects, either archaeological objects or art historical objects, and stuff like that. And there are so many documents and literature talking about horses and humans during the Norwegian history that is not really connected with the horse world of today. And we want to understand the horse-human relationship in all its complexity. And we want to understand how our shared history also influences us today. We used to be partners in war, in transportation, in agriculture, but today horses and humans are primarily companions in recreational or performance-driven activities. And this shift must have done something with our relation to the horses. And of course, it also raises new ethical questions about purpose, welfare, and how we spend time together. So we want to add more a deeper understanding and also some a deeper identity to horse people of today in how we can live with horses.
Now that's very interesting. And you are not just historians in an archive, you are actually horse people, right? Maybe,
yes.
Sosa, that's also a question for you. So how is that playing into that research group?
It's a very interesting group. The research group consists of different scholars, but mm-hmm. also people like me. I'm a visual artist and a freelancer, so I'm invited into the group by Caroline, along with other people with also this kind of more visual background. We have a person who works in a design department at Oslo Met, right, Caroline?
Yeah, Christiania.
University of Christiania. And then there are archaeologists and people from literature and history and so on. And also quite a big part of the group are also employed at the museum, but different backgrounds. But what unites us is, of course, the interest in horses, and that everybody has a background with horses or are working with horses today as some kind of, not as their professional work, but as a very big part of their lives. It's more or less in the group, but some of us work more with horses than others.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah.
So basically you're bridging what we are doing today with archaeology and culture, and that's really interesting. I think it's a unique project. I haven't heard about something alike before, or is there something like this somewhere else in the world?
That's a good question. I'm not aware of similar initiatives at the moment, but I won't say that it doesn't exist, but I'm pretty
No.
sure this is the first initiative in Norway, at least, where we gather such a big group from many different perspectives. And another aim we have is, of course, to always be in close contact with the horse sector and the professionals from the horse sector, so that we can really draw on each other's expertise historically, visually, and from the practice, because we bring different knowledges onto the table. So I think with this sh shared or sh with this sharing of knowledge and perspectives, we all can learn from each other. So it kind of also brings us or it makes us even in the sharing, because we all bring something differently, which is very interesting.
I imagine that must be super interesting conversations that you are having there when you are kind of, bringing all this expertise together on one table.
Yeah, and I mean this initiative, it comes from Caroline. She's kind of the mastermind that have kind of she's been working on this concept in different shapes, and then now it's kind of it was in January this year that she I think or February that you called in people for the first time, and then together we are kind of shaping how we are going to work. So far we have been looking at different directions for our work. And Caroline is the one who's kind of been drawing different people in as
But that's a very good point, that we are actually shaping this the structure together, and that we want to explore different ways of working. Some of us are theoretical, others are more practical in our work style, and that also requires different sets of working. So, for example, one way we are now trying to explore is something we call a working seminar, or it's like a science sector seminar, where we combine a public event with a working seminar in the research group, and then followed by actual horse practice in a horse clinic. So with like 4 days actually in together, that we can meet and have a conversation about a selected topic over several days together from very different perspectives, also including a broader audience who may be interested in the topics that we are discussing. Yeah, so that was just like we are now trying to find different ways of working together as a group, and to see the relevance in each other's perspective and how we can learn from each other. So it's still like in its early phase that way.
I think independent of everything else, this alone already has a big value that people are opening their mind and just looking at different perspectives. And I wish we have more initiatives like this within the equine sector. It would be so good for everybody.
That would.
Sorry, Sosa, please, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I just will underline that because in the group, like me, who has a more, as a visual artist, I have more practical and maybe speculative approach to things. And it's so nice to meet people that has a totally different approach, and that it's possible to communicate and Yeah, sometimes I feel that I'm a wild card, but then I see that somebody is picking up on what I'm saying, and then I really feel reinforced that, that I have a value in this context, and also my horse background plays in there. So it's a very kind of strengthening, how to say, strengthening my believe in what I'm doing and connecting the different fields that I'm interested in. So it's very great to be a part of it.
Yeah, we together we kind of create a new language in how to understand horses from the past to the present.
From the past, yes. What kind of historical sources are you working with? There must have been a spark that, was pushing you into the direction of creating all of this.
Yeah, and that spark is probably m directed a bit from my background in interdisciplinary historical work. So I have been working with many different historical sources, from rock art, runestones, medieval manuscripts, texts, and art history, and of course also archaeological objects, riding and driving tacks, for example. From prehistoric graves. So, for example, we are also now looking into a very exciting and special saddle that has been associated with a female burial from Oseberg, a grave two women that was buried in 834. And they were buried together with 15 horses, sledges, a carriage, different horse tacks, and also this saddle. It's a very curious saddle. So this is something, we want to work with.
And that caught my attention, the saddle, and also you said 54?
34, yes,
34,
800.
yeah. Wow. Why is this so important?
There are many things that we can actually say is important with that, but this grave is one of the most spectacular Viking graves in the world. It is extremely well preserved, the finds from this grave, and the biggest find, of course, is a ship, a very big and nicely decorated and ornamented Viking ship, super well preserved. And that is, of course, the object, if we can call it that has kind of generated most interest internationally so far. Because it says also something about burial practice, and but it also all the objects that are kind of left in the grave also says something about the way of living and the maybe ritual practices and symbolism in the Viking Age. But the saddle as part of this grave has caught less attention. It has caught attention, and it has been interpreted differently by scholars, but still we think that it's a reason now to look more deep into this and this the curious shape of it and why it was placed within the grave chamber together, close together with the women who was buried. So this is something, it's kind of a narrative or a living truth that women didn't ride in the historical days, and they have been more associated with driving. But we want to question that and ask if it was possible for women to ride, and how did they ride, and what can we learn from that? Can we also give more identity to the modern rider by adding some feminine or women perspectives to the riding?
That's a very strong narrative, right? The narrative that the writing in history culturally was historical dominated, and that's something that you are challenging there with this find, if I understand that correctly. That's an important one. That's a big
I think
one.
it, we can mention because very much of the writing history is connected to war, and it's like a general assumption that there were, of course, more men who participated in the wars, and the technology of riding, tacks, and how people rode has been mainly understood by war horses. So by the, also kind of elevating other objects that can maybe broaden the history of riding and also include women into the narrative, that is very fruitful, we hope.
And there is the idea about the women in the ship is either that one of them is a queen, or maybe she's like a religious leader. And the ship is a vessel in itself, and then it's full of other types of transportation items, like the sledges and the wagons and so on. And it's very curious that the saddle is not meant to be traveled in if it's in the ship with all those other kind of objects for traveling. But one of the interpretations that has or are existing is that the saddle should represent a male force, like a king or something in
Ah,
the ship.
also interesting.
Yeah, so.
Yeah,
But as a horsewoman, we doubt that a little bit. That she has had
yeah.
also she had
I mean,
also
it's interesting.
16 horses with her in the grave.
And then she's
So
not riding. That's a bit wild.
yeah, for us that's
I think at least
obvious.
it's a very good it's a big potential here that
Yeah.
she could have been riding.
Yeah. And at this time in Norway, you know, people were traveling, of course, long distances with boats because the roads were not that many. This Caroline maybe knows, but you know, it's easier to travel off-road with in a saddle than with a wagon.
Yes, you need quite a good path or road actually to use it for a wagon or a sledge. So I think riding must have been very outspread. It must have been very common to ride in this country, stony and hilly and a lot of forest. So definitely. It must be part of our history.
Yeah, and it's not so far, and not so far-fetched. I mean, when I'm looking here at our road, that was just built in the 70s. So there was simply no road available before.
Yeah, exactly.
No tractor, no road. How were you going from A to B? Yeah, with farm horse. So very simple. Well, when you're looking at Google Maps, most of the maps still don't have the name of this little road here that we are having. So it's just for me, it sounds absolutely logical. Now, I'm not an expert in that, but for me, that sounds very logical.
And also, this ship was found a little bit, around 19, is it 1903 or something? Or it has been found many times, but it was excavated at the beginning,
Enough for
What do you mean when you say
1904.
it was found many times?
Yeah, there have been like burglars, you know. Yeah, so often there are myths that are kind of saying, oh, okay, here is a ship grave or something, and then people start to dig through history, you know.
Yeah, grave robbery, and then
Yeah. Or curiosity or whatever. But in
Well,
1904 it was only
excavated.
men that were, you know, excavating the ship.
At
least mainly men.
Mainly? Okay, was there any women?
I don't have the team
Neither, okay. I
names, but
was
we cannot
I'm
really.
just heading at you know, interpretation that
But the history, like on a general note, we can say that history has been dominated by men, people of history and also archaeology. But there have been also many strong women archaeologists throughout time. So, but still, the like more generally historical perspectives are truly dominated by men, and that also affect the way we look at history, that the men are often in focus, also historically. So it's like a tendency to elevate the history about legal matters and activities where men have been part of the activities. And nothing is wrong with that, absolutely not. But it's also now we understand so much about history that we also, and we are so many people working with historical topics now, so we can also broaden our historical knowledge and include, for example, women, animals, and children into the historical narrative, so we can learn more about how also human interacted with animals and with each other, and not only with those social structures that were kind of more formal structures in the historical society.
Yes, I understand. So you're not only asking how did people write, but also who was writing or who wrote and for what? What is the reason for it? And then you are bringing in a broader perspective, which also was a feministic view, because that is important. And I think, that's maybe a question for you too. But my interpretation is, when I'm looking at what do we know today and what is the narratives that we very often use, that the female perspective is maybe a little bit silent sometimes.
Yes, definitely. And I think that is in many different parts of social behavior. So, but we have the opportunity now to put more focus onto the feministic perspectives, and but also animal perspectives, because the animals are also lacking in what we know about the history. So it's kind of a time now to focus on the others, those who have not been part of the history so far. And I think it's extremely important to understand that humans have not been able to shape this society without animals, without horses. We have been totally dependent on the horses for our way of living today. So I think it's something that is also very deep in the human as a species, that we have a need of being together with horses, because we have domesticated horses for thousands of years and shaped our lives after what we can do with the horses. And it's kind of a broken line that is kind of modern. It's only maybe the last 60, 70 years that we have no formal practical needs in being together with horses anymore. So it was a very abrupt change that left the horses being a more something for leisure activities and not anything that kind of not for transportation in the cities, not for harvesting the fields, and so on and so forth. So now we need to find a new identity. What is our purpose of being together with animals and horses in particular today, since we have this innate need to be together with animals? And that is a big motivation for me, at least, to find out more about this shaping humans, shaping animals to stay and live together, and how we organize our lives together.
That's very interesting. And when I'm looking at the old farm books here, we are so lucky that we have the old books from our farm. It was founded in 1930. we can still see the last farm horse was bought somewhere in the 60s. And it was a year's salary that was going into this youngster. It was a year's salary. It was simply a different value also that the horse had.
That's super interesting. That is also something we see in the historical sources, that the if you first had a horse, you treated that horse very, very well,
Very well, yes.
because it was super expensive, and the education you put into the horse is also so valuable. So if you first have like a horse-human relation, you took care of that
Yes.
horse because you didn't want to
Yes.
lose it.
And the generation that I met, my father-in-law and my husband, they never had an own farm horse. It was the generation before that had the last farm horse here, and he was living, I think, on the farm until he was 30. Even when the tractor came, the horse wasn't replaced, he was still hanging out. Still, this tradition also of taking good care of the animal is very deeply rooted. So my father-in-law thinks I don't know it. I hope he doesn't listen to my podcast. He thinks I don't know it. But especially in winter, I see him every morning with his 86 years going out and feeding carrots to my ponies. And when my ponies are going to the Utmark in summer, so when he goes patur, he always has goodies for the horses. He thinks it's a bit weird that we don't feed them potato peel anymore, but otherwise he's very, he's very observant, and he is very much looking out of his living room window and if the horses are fine and how are they doing. So it appears to be deeply rooted in the culture. It was passed on from generation to generation, and we still have the old farm tools lying here under the barn. And I very much hope that I can use them one day, and I'm learning one day to work also the ground, work the fields a bit with them. That would be cool. That's my private project.
It's so nice doing that.
I mean, I am trying to develop that. Yeah. So.
But you are. I know at least that you're doing Hesse.
Yeah, that's true, but that is without the horse so far. But
We have to have a workshop there.
yeah. No, but I am collecting some equipment, and I've been driving in my one of my horses, and she is so far pulling firewood. I mean timber, like small timber. Yeah. So that's a start, and I also flattened my riding arena. What is it? Hardware. Yeah, even the arena with her. So that's so she's just starting up, but it's also me that's starting up because it's not so easy to get somebody to help me, and some of the equipment are a bit scary. So yeah, and I.
Interesting.
Yeah, and I don't know the names in English, but some of them are, to gather grass and stuff. They are, yeah, you have to do it right, otherwise you'll cut your toes, it's not the
I've seen videos online from how the societies in the US called that are not having any electricity and stuff. Yeah, I'm
Amish people.
Thank you. From Amish people who are still doing that today, I was extremely impressed how well that was working. That was sparking for me my interest. So I think that's very, very interesting. Let's go back to our original conversation here. Horses are just such a big topic. I like to talk about them.
But I'm winding back to this, the break. Let's say Second World War after that, then horses are disappearing from everyday life, more or less. But when I grew up, I also were very interested in my grandfather's generation. So it's kind of jumping over my parents and then into those who had the relationship with horses from their lives. And from I was a very little girl, I always want to visit those, the old uncles and these people. So it's also human, this kind of
Factor.
knowledge attraction that I experienced as a child. But sadly, these people are not living anymore. But yeah.
It's very interesting because it's so much of the knowledge about horses that is transmitted orally or through practice and from generation to generation. And traditional knowledge and tacit knowledge. So it's not easy to read up on, for example, the historical way of agriculture with horses. So this is something you need to find someone who knows how to do it and that who are willing to teach you how to use the tools. And I think maybe that is also the things that you experienced as a child, that those people they had a knowledge, a type of knowledge that you also wanted to be part of. So this
Absolutely.
traditional knowledge that is not so easy to express with words or with the text and stuff.
And then as a child, if you had a chance to look at somebody who's practicing something, you just hang with your grandfather when he's doing the practical things, then it kind of goes into your brain in a
Different
certain
way.
way. Yeah.
And this is something that we want to address in our research group because we want to kind of to highlight this traditional knowledge and make it more accessible. So if that is to organize seminars, workshops, open meetings, or at least some kind of sharing of knowledge, and maybe some of this we also want to put into texts, of course, but the aim is at least to kind of to remedy that gap in our history with horses, and to try to find new ways of transmitting this this knowledge, traditional knowledge.
Because there is a certain danger if we are just trying from a modern perspective to interpret that, right?
Yeah, I think we lose a lot. I think today it's there are so many kind of truths about how we should use different equipment and tacks, and what we should do with our horses, and which movements are good and which are bad. But I think this is something that we need to look deeper into, and also to understand what the initial original meaning of the bits, for example, what was that? Why were they produced? What kind of function was meant from a bit and from various types of bits? What kind of function did people seek when they invented types of saddles, for example? So that we don't take things for granted. We should look into the original meaning and the original function and try to understand how things have developed. Because there are some missing links, I think, between today's practice and the past.
That sounds like your research might change the way modern writers or modern Norwegians, at least, are thinking about their equestrian tradition.
We can at least hope that it will add some more knowledge to the field. I think it's also it has been asked for more knowledge, more also theoretical knowledge in the field of animal welfare, for example. And I think by understanding more how things were meant to be, and how things have developed for the worse or for the better, that is also part of the knowledge that needs to be spread out and made known so that people can make more informed choices when they choose their way of riding or their way of tacking up the horses.
Was there any aha moment so far? Was there any moment in your research already where you think, oh, that's changing something here? Or is that too early, maybe?
Yeah, I think for me the biggest aha so far is this realization that we have lived so closely with horses, and we cannot understand ourselves as a species without understanding the way we have lived with horses. So that kind of reflection or aha has been important for me, and also made me very curious about, or I realized that there is a lot of things that I don't know about how things were meant to be used and things that I want to learn more about. And of course, it may change our perspectives if we find out more about women riding. And also, I am very curious about the level of riding. How did people educate their horses back in the days? Because it has also been like, it's a general saying that we didn't ride, or at least not on a high level in Norway, because there are not so many sources, at least not written sources, from riding masters, or no well-known riding masters from the 16th, 17th, 18th century. But I think we can maybe add to that understanding by the way of looking into the texts and also art historical depictions and literary depictions, how humans describe their interaction with the horses. Maybe we can also find out more about the level of education, and that is interesting, I think.
Absolutely, very. Let's talk a little bit about the collaboration with Bent. What's the idea of bringing Bent Branderup into this? And then you are hosting a very cool event in Oslo at the museum. Here in May, we will link also the tickets. It's a public event, so we are linking the tickets for the audience in the show notes. If you would like to come, you're very welcome. I think there are still tickets available. So, what's the idea about that? What can we learn from that?
We can say that Bent is a living link to historical riding, and he has spent his life in diving into the history of riding. So I think he's a very good source and collaborator for us to understand more of what we see and the equipment that we want to investigate. So his deep knowledge in function about function form, and also his philosophy that connects with modern perspectives of welfare, is extremely helpful for us in our search of the historical past. It also kind of helps us to connect not only with the practical or the object-related stuff, but also more to the feeling about riding, how and the level of education, I think, because he has this immense experience.
And it will be also very interesting for us to see Bent in a different context. You know, he is always lecturing about his findings and how he thinks that things used to function in history, and how he has tried out and failed and succeeded and all these things. And to bring this knowledge to a broader audience in the museum, that's also very interesting for us as academic riders and horse people to see how that kind of resonates with a broader audience that we don't reach in our academic circles.
So just about the practicality, so Ben will give a lecture in this it's a public event on Thursday afternoon, where he will give this lecture about the history of riding, and we will combine that also with some a short little introduction about what sources that we have in our museum, the Museum of Cultural History in Oslo, that can kind of shed light of the history of riding in Norway, particularly. And then the day after Friday, we invite Bent and also some other horse professionals into a more focused seminar looking at objects together with the research group.
Shall we
So
say
it
the date for the lecture? It's the 22nd of May for the listeners. In
Very
Oslo.
good. And then we hope that we will have a replica of the exciting Oseberg saddle ready for testing that out in the weekend clinic with Bent in
Okay,
Sarpsborg, Finland.
now I'm catching you. I'm framing this a little bit because we are so deep in the topic. I'm trying to frame that here for our audience because we have a little a three-part structure there. We have a public event at the museum where you can get tickets for, and then we have a closed seminar for experts and practitioners that you can't get tickets for. That's for our private nerdiness and for the museum's nerdiness. But after that, then we continue to go to a weekend clinic with Bent, and then we are continue to do it a little bit. What my mission here at Academia is, we are trying to connect science and soulfulness and thinking and doing. And there the replica comes in because Caroline has spent with her team some time of creating this replica. And of course, we would like to see how does this work in practice? What can we learn for the past, from the past for the present? And does it at all, does it still fit? Do we have a horse where the saddle is fitting on? How does it behave?
Yeah, that's very interesting. This is one of our colleagues in the museum, part of the or member of the research group, Bjarte Aarseth, who has made this wooden copy of the saddle, and we are now trying to fit it onto one of my horses. It's an Icelandic horse that we think is maybe most like what the Viking horse could look like. So the saddle is quite small, and it fits. It's his back. It seems to fit his back or rib cage at least well. So that's a good start. And now we try to find some ways of fastening the saddle around the horse, so that it actually can carry a rider also. And we hope to get that ready for the weekend clinic, so that Ben can guide us a bit in how to use it and how it may have been used in the past.
So
That
we will
is
have
a good
a
question.
live testing next week with
Super.
the saddle and different other things that we think we need for the horse. The horse's welfare. I mean, it's wood, the whole thing.
Yes.
It's made
Yes.
of a root, a big root.
Yeah.
Or it was originally. I don't know if
So, like
the
one piece, it's carved out from
no,
one
it's
piece.
several pieces actually.
Okay.
So it's now it's yeah, it's maybe three or maybe they're the two main pieces, and then it's a back swizzle. I don't know in English, but but that is also now in three pieces, but it's supposed to be one, or Carolina?
Yeah, I think so. I think the technicalities there will be easier to clarify when we look into the 3D model that has been made, a scan of the saddle. That is also important for us in understanding how things have been fastened, and the different pieces have been plugged together and also tied together. That is, for example, something we will discuss a bit the coming week, how things have been tied together and also tied around the horse, or what kind of girth and other things has been fastened
If
to
there
the
was a
saddle.
girl at all,
yeah, there were,
Yeah.
there was
Yeah.
maybe,
You can be sure about it. Yeah.
and also you are sitting with your legs quite much forward, and the women who were in the grave, they were quite small. One of them were 152,
Around that,
54,
yeah.
yeah, and so there are many aspects that are. We have, it's like a riddle. We have the saddle parts, we have the some parts of the skeletons of the women are existing, some horse skeletons, and everything from leather is gone. Textile is
Of
more or less
course.
gone. Yeah. So, So that is also kind of what I find very exciting, that it's this kind of, that you have these parts, and then you have to try to make a sentence of all these kind of fragments of words that you have kind of in physical objects in front of you. So, yeah, so you have to use imagination and physical, what fits kind of. And try
That
to
would be
look
bad.
at other cultures, how are things, old images, and yeah.
That will become super interesting to see if theory and practice then is coming together. And yeah, I'm looking forward to that. So let's wrap this up here a little bit. I have a last question, or more or less last question for you. What would be your dream collaboration look like? If budget and logistics are no limit, what would be your dream for this project for the future?
I think that must have be or must be a possibility to travel as a group around and explore different academies and ways of teaching horses and riders of today, and to learn from different cultures what exists where, and to develop this way of talking and understanding each other, and learning from each other's perspective. So, connecting stables, universities, museums, and the a broader horse the horse sector in general. So where we meet with our shared interest in horses, that must be a dream to kind of
Yeah,
be
and
able to.
we also need peace on Earth, because we need to open up the borders so that we don't think in sectors, because influences can have been coming from all over the globe, also here to Norway. So,
Yes, from the east, for example. Yeah, that's a very nice vision. That's a very nice vision. So then I am looking forward to seeing you two next week, hands on in real life, and
Yes, looking forward.
looking at all this exciting stuff and at the weekend's discussion that are coming up there.
Yeah, we are super excited. It's so cool when things connect in this kind of good way.
Yeah. I would like to say thank you for the initiative. It's a really great initiative, and I'm grateful that we can support that a little bit with the organization. And
Thank you, Selina. That's great. We are very grateful for the collaboration about this.
I am too. So we will, for everybody who's listening, we are linking the tickets to both the museum event and to the weekend clinic in Sarpsborg in the show notes. And I hope that we see as many people as possible there. The more the merrier. We have a lot of space. And then I'll see you soon. Have a good
See you
day.
soon.
See you.
Thank you. As we are preparing for the upcoming event with Bent Brandrup and the Museum of Oslo, where academic writing meets academic research, I hope today's conversation gave you a glimpse into just how deep the human-horse connection runs. My warmest thanks to Caroline, head of the research group The Horse, and Cesar Jorgensen for offering such a thought-provoking creative perspectives to all of us. Together, they remind us that the way we train and care for horses today is part of a much longer and richer story, and it's up to us to write the next chapter with more awareness, more knowledge, and more soul. You'll find more about the museum, the research group, and the event in the show notes. You will also find tickets for the following course with Ben Brandhove in the writing arena in the show notes. If this episode resonates with you, please share it, leave a review, reach out to us. Let's grow this conversation together. And until next time, stay curious, stay kind, keep listening, and maybe we meet in Oslo. See you.